Right, so this is Caden Gibson. I'm interviewing Aghazi Tesfai. I'm currently at Geisel Library talking to Aghazi over the phone. So first off, I just wanted to ask what your date of birth is, as well as your place of birth.
I was born on January 4th, 1992, and I was born in San Diego.
So can you describe San Diego, your hometown?
Yeah, sure. So I lived mostly in the southeastern region of San Diego my whole life. I grew up in a neighborhood called, well, actually the apartments complex is Bayview Heights. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but there are a lot of different ethnic groups that reside in that area. So I grew up with a lot of Ethiopians, Somalians, Mexicans, African Americans, you name it. And then my family relocated to Lemon Grove, and we've been there ever since.
So Bayview Heights, which community is that in Southeast San Diego?
So it's, I don't know how to describe it. It's not too far from Lemon Grove, but it's, what are the cross streets? It's, I'll have to look it up on my, on my
That's
phone.
Fine. So I guess I wanted to ask, what was your childhood home like?
We lived in a small apartment. It was just my parents and my two younger brothers. I'm the oldest. And, we lived in like a two bedroom apartment, and I remember we had, you know, playground nearby, basketball courts, and the kind of, area that we grew up in. It was very, very open. That's the way I can describe it. It was like, it seemed like nobody's doors were locked ever. We would just go from house to house, visit friends, and you know, in the Ethiopian culture, drinking coffee is one of the biggest pastimes, especially for ladies, where they'd come together and have coffee for a few hours and chat, and it's a very social time. And so I had some family members that lived in the area as well. And yeah, it was I would find it to be a great place to grow up in terms of having social support and access to, you know, family, friends, all those things that you would need.
Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned that about coffee. That's actually one of my favorite pastimes as well. Not to say that I got it from any particular culture. It's just, I guess I inherited that obsession from my mom. So do you have any favorite childhood memories living there?
I guess, let me see. I think one of my favorite childhood memories is probably we used to play, all of the kids in the neighborhood, we used to play like hide and go seek, but it wasn't confined to a particular area. So it would be like the whole entire neighborhood, which was, I don't know the square footage, but it was very, very wide space. And so we would spend hours playing. And, you know, if you were the person that was trying to find people, sometimes you'd get so tired, you'd just go home and you'd end the game on your own. And playing at the basketball courts and playing in the playground was a lot of fun. We didn't really have very many like bikes and, you know, different toys and stuff. So I remember we used to get rollerblades. Like there was one family that, one of the girls that I was friends with, she had a pair of rollerblades. So we would wear one, and we would go around the neighborhood and maybe like one or two times, and then we'd switch off And that's how we would play.
So would you say that that was like your favorite time of the day as a kid?
My favorite time of the day would probably be after school, because after, you know, after we would get back, we would all take the bus together. We'd go on the bus stop and some of the kids would go to the middle schools or elementary schools, and then we'd come back. And then after school, yeah, I guess that would be around 3 or 4 p.m. And yeah, that was a great time.
Reminds me a lot of my own childhood. And, you know, I apologize if I'm, like, really nonverbal while you're answering. Like, they've been saying, our professor's been saying, you know, when the other person's talking, just to, you know, sit there and listen, to be nonverbal. So I hope you aren't concerned about that.
No worries.
All right. So, next, I wanted to ask, what are your parents' names?
My mother's name is Sahai Walde, and my father's name is Tesfai Takala.
And what about your grandparents' names?
My grandmother, from both sides.
Whichever one you find most, or the most memorable grandparents, because I guess I'm trying to steer you towards, like, your, like, the most memorable memories with your grandparents.
Sure. So my father's parents passed away. I never got the chance to meet them. They were living in Ethiopia. And my mother's father also passed away. So I've only met my mother's mother. Her name was Kasich, but we would call her Abba. And she came to the U.S. few years ago, and she stayed with us for a few years, and now she's back in Ethiopia living there with some of her nieces and some of her kids.
So you said you only met your grandmother when you were a child. What do you remember most about your parents and your grandmother as a child?
Well, I met my grandmother, I was a teenager at that point. She was a very calm person. She's very old. We don't really, the older generation, say my grandparents and on, they don't really know their age. So they're, because, you know, they're born at home most of the time, and they don't go to the hospital, so they didn't really have birth certificates. So a lot of times when they approximate their age based on like current events or things that have happened, or holidays, like what holiday were they born, like what was the closest holiday that they were born. I'm not phrasing that correctly. But
I understand that.
She was maybe in her, when she came, she was in her 70s, so she's probably in her 80s now. As far as her demeanor, she was very calm, she was very, very pleasant. She was kind of ill. She had a bad cough. The first time she'd actually seen, like, you know, gone checked out by a physician and gotten, you know, labs and tests done was when she came to the U.S. in the, I think she came in maybe 2008 or so. So she had a bad cough, and it was because they do a lot of cooking over an open flame. And so I think the smoke over the years kind of caused her to develop this cough. So I remember her always carrying a handkerchief with her and just, you know, coughing all the time.
Yeah. So is your whole family from Ethiopia, or does any part of your family have a different nationality or ethnicity?
No, I would say most of them, as far as I know, they're from Ethiopia.
So I wanted to ask, like, what can you tell me about, about what your parents and what your grandma did for a living.
What they did when they were living in Ethiopia, or what they do now?
You could describe both of them. Either one works.
So my mother and my father, they were students in Ethiopia. My dad, he stopped going to school, I think when he was in the ninth grade, because that's when a civil war broke out, and so no one could really go to school. That wasn't the main concern at the time. It was very difficult to go to school, so he dropped out in the ninth grade. And my mother, she went to high school and completed high school, and they were really young, so they didn't do much work in Ethiopia before they left to different countries, neighboring countries. My grandmother never worked. Her husband was a farmer, and he had livestock and crops, and so she would help him tend to the animals and pretty much care for the land, and that's how they made their living. When my parents came to the U.S., my mom went into the health field. She became a CNA, a nurse assistant, and now she's working as a cardiac monitor. And my father became a cab driver, and he's still a cab driver today.
Do you know how your parents met?
They met here in San Diego. So my father, he left from Ethiopia to go to Sudan. And from Sudan, he got political asylum to come to the U.S. and ended up in San Diego. And my mother, she went through a refugee camp in Kenya. And I believe it was the Red Cross that brought her over to San Diego. And before she left the refugee camp, there was a woman there that found out that my mother was going to America. And she said that she had a friend that was living in America, and she wanted my mother to give her a letter, give a letter to her friend that was living in America. They had no idea where. They didn't know about states or how big the country was, but all they knew was that she was going to America, and the woman's friend lived in America. So she was like, please make sure she gets this letter. And my mom said, okay. And so she ends up here in San Diego, and she starts, she connects with other Ethiopians here at Job Corps and asks if anyone knows who the woman is, and who the recipient of the letter. And no one really knew, but they directed her to my father, who had been here for a few years. He was kind of one of the, he had been in San Diego, I think, the longest compared to the others that had been there. And so she asked him, and he actually said, yes, I know that woman. She's my friend's wife. And so he took the letter and gave it to the woman. And after that, they, I guess they liked each other. And here we are now with the three kids. And
so you mentioned that your dad went through Sudan to arrive here. Did he land in City Heights before, meeting your mom and then, having the kids, moving to Baby Heights? Or was there some different story?
He arrived in San Diego. I'm not exactly sure what part of San Diego, but he met my mother, I think, at Job Corps. Have you heard of Job Corps?
I have heard of Job Corps, yes. I only ask about City Heights because I know that a lot of refugees land in City Heights. They soon after arriving. So I thought, hey,
They did. I think he did have an apartment near 54th. Mm-hmm. So it's very close by to City Heights, like, you know, University and 54th in that general area. So, yeah, I guess that was their, that they lived in kind of in that neighborhood in their early years before going to Baby Heights.
Did your parents ever describe to you their experiences going through the process of immigration?
Well, they a little bit. My dad told me that that they had to go through some kind of orientation before coming to the States. It was kind of like a cultural orientation about what to expect when they get here, and those kind of things. And my mom, she didn't tell me too much about the whole process of immigration, but she did say that they, Red Cross brought her here and put her in an apartment with another woman who had a child who is also a new refugee, and I think they gave her $20, and it was pretty much it. It was kind of like, you know, you had to make a living after that, figure out the process.
So were they the only ones within their family to travel, or were there other members of the family with them?
No, they were on their own. My mom, she did go with her. She went with her cousin, I believe. They just went to the border of Kenya, and they were told, I guess other people that knew that they were going to be making this journey just told them to head to the border and, you know, approach the soldiers with their hands raised, and they pretty much just took them in, and I guess they ended up in the refugee camp. My father, he didn't travel with family, but he traveled with members of his village. So it's, you know, they're not like immediate family members, but he was saying on their journey towards Sudan, their numbers grew as they kept traveling. And by the end of it, they were close to maybe 80 or, you know, to 100 people when they started with just a small handful of people from his village. But, you know, along the way, people joined them, and there was a large group of them by the time they made it. But he didn't leave with any of his immediate family members.
So do your parents maintain the connections with the people that they traveled with, or was it, you know, just everyone split off afterwards?
I would say that my father, when he was living in Sudan, he had friends that actually ended up in San Diego as well. So we're still in touch with them, and I know them. And a lot of people actually that live here in San Diego that came through Sudan, they all know each other, and they all remember their time together in Sudan. My mother, on the other hand, I don't think she kept in touch with, apart from her cousin. I don't think there's anyone from the refugee camp that she is still in contact with today.
Did your parents ever talk about any kind of, I guess, when they first arrived, any kind of like culture shock type experiences? Or did the orientation that you mentioned, did that help them understand, I guess, the cultural things that happen here?
As far as the orientation, I'm not sure about the details or what types of things they talked about. But I think when they came here, it was very difficult for them in the beginning, because just, you know, being able to attain resources, you know, to maintain a living one of the most challenging things. Like they said that, I remember my father saying that, you know, they had to use a payphone. They didn't have to, you know, they didn't know necessarily how to, you know, get a phone, get a plan. And it was just all kind of very difficult to figure out the system and how to enroll in school and those kind of things. I mean, I think they had some help with different agencies to help them with enrolling in school. But yeah, it was very different for them.
Were they able to find like a community of other refugees to like help figure things out? Like, were they able to lean on anyone for help?
Yeah, definitely. They there were other Ethiopians living here already, and so especially in Bayview Heights, there were so many Ethiopians living there. So there is a strong social support in that aspect.
So I guess I want to bring you, I guess, back towards like your family and the dynamic that you have with them. So you mentioned you had two siblings, three kids.
Yes, I have two younger siblings.
And okay, so you're the oldest. And is it, you know, two brothers, two sisters, a brother and a sister?
I have two brothers.
What are your brothers' names?
One of my brothers is Jonas, and the youngest one is Samuel.
And I assume they're both students.
Yes, they are. They're both students. Samuel is in high school, and Jonas is in college.
I hope you don't mind me asking what schools they go to.
Samuel goes to Helix High School and Jonas is at Grossmont College.
Oh, I have friends at Helix High School. So what is the dynamic like between you and your siblings?
We get along great. I kind of have there's 5 years in between me and Jonas, and there's 9 years in between me and Samuel. So kind of assume a motherly role with them. But we definitely, you know, are able to joke around and laugh with each other. And the boys are 5 years apart. So I think they're a little bit closer and have a more, I would say, like more sibling kind of relationship. But for me, it's more of, you know, like I am the second mom, you know, protector. I'm encouraging them, you know, with their studies, and I try my best to help them figure out, you know, their path to college and those sorts of things.
So is that common to Ethiopian culture to have like a way older sibling to be like an additional parent for the younger siblings?
Yeah, I would say that the eldest child or the older siblings definitely play a part in the upbringing of the younger children.
Go ahead.
And parents definitely rely on the older siblings to, you know, facilitate with, you know, family matters and ensuring that, you know, the kids are taken care of and that, you know, things like house chores and just matters pertaining to the home are, you know, the older kids help out with that.
So you'd say that there's like as the oldest child that there's more responsibility, more stress placed on you than your younger siblings?
I would say that there are certain responsibilities that may fall on the eldest child that may not necessarily apply to the younger ones. But I mean, within my family, there are still very high expectations of all of us to thrive and do well in school and, you know, help out with the family.
So is there a difference between the ground rules set between you and your siblings? Because I know that there's that age aspect between you two, but then there's also that gender aspect, whereas, you know, you're a woman and they are, you know, men, males.
The roles of maybe preparing meals, you know, cooking and cleaning. I would say for the boys, they're encouraged to do those things. But I mean, for girls, it's kind of assumed that, you know, you should be doing these things.
So was there also like a different kind of rule or advice with regard to, you know, relationships, dating? It, you know, was this taboo? Did they not mention this?
No, we never really talked about dating or relationships. I mean, once in a while we'd talk about marriage, but that's as far as it would go. It's not really a thing that we would do in our culture, where we would just date and, you know, bring a significant other to meet our parents. It's more, the culture has more emphasis on, you know, getting married when it's time to get married.
So I wanted to ask if you know what the origin of history of your family name is? Because I know that the last name Tesfai is a very common name from what I've heard, at least from people at the South Sudanese Center and from Jordanos.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, my last name is Tesfai. Jordanos' last name is Tesfai. it's a very common name. In terms of the origin of the name, I don't know what the exact origin is. I know that it means hope in our language. A lot of our names have a meaning. Like my name means freedom, and my brother's names, they're biblical. Samuel and Jonas is John in English. My mother's name, Sahai, means son. So the way that we pass along the family name is the children receive the father's first name as their last name. So my father's first name is Tesfai, and my last name would be Tesfai. My grandfather's name was Takala, so that is my father's last name. And it might sound a little confusing, but
oh no, it makes a lot of sense. It makes sense to me. I'm just gonna have to ask that you like send me a spelling of some of their names later on, so I can transcribe this, because I have to transcribe this after I'm done with the interview. So I want to switch over to, I guess, like your life as a student. So I guess I'll ask what kind of schools you attended before coming here? You're a UCSD student, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so before UCSD.
Yeah, I went to Marvin Elementary School. And then when we moved, I went to San Altos Elementary. And then middle school, I went to Palm Middle School in Lemon Grove, and then to Grossmont High School. And then from Grossmont, I took classes at Grossmont College, and I took classes at Mesa College as well. And then I transferred to UCSD.
So prior to college, what were some of the more memorable events you had in school?
Just all K through 12?
I suppose, yeah.
Okay. One of my most memorable memories from school.
Anything from an extracurricular or a special award that your parents were like super proud of?
I did a chemistry internship. I think my junior year of high school, I got to study with one of the chem labs in La Jolla. The program was called TSRI, the Scripps Research Institute. It was just a summer program, and for 2 months I got to do my own research and synthesize proteins, and I had to do a final presentation in front of graduate students, postdocs, and it was a very interesting experience.
So did that follow you into, college? Did you continue on the path of like doing chemistry?
No, actually, I realized I really don't like being in a lab. It was a wonderful experience, and I got to meet a lot of great people, and but I didn't really enjoy lab work as much as I thought I would. I changed my major when I came to UCSD from biochemistry to public health. So I wanted to stay within, the health field. But public health was a little bit more versatile. And I thought, with this type of training, I'd be able to become involved with communities and to have more of like an in-person type of interaction when it comes to helping people with whatever health needs that they have.
Is there anything that you do currently outside of classes that have to do with public health?
I do work at for an organization called United Women of East Africa Support Team.
Oh, yeah.
So we do a lot of work with the different East African communities in City Heights. And we offer so many programs in terms of tutoring, education for youth, women's health. We have a lot of mental health programs that we work on with the youth in our community.
I didn't realize that outside of like mental health that there was like a public health program within United Women of East Africa that, I guess it focuses on public health. Because before volunteering, I'd read that there was support for like mental health, drug prevention, but I didn't know that there was like public health practices other than that United Women of East Africa actually provided.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that almost anything is public health.
Yeah.
when you look at, all the different factors that, contribute to one's well-being and, all the different, determinants of health, that's one of the biggest concepts that we have in public health. So, and we do things to help people get on track with their education, with, workforce development training. We even have Girl Scouts for younger girls that are like in elementary and middle school. We support entrepreneurship. We have a program for the women that come to the center. I'm sure you've seen them, but they do a lot of the catering, and so there's so many things that we do at the center. And one of the biggest things that we do focus on is mental health, because there's a particular need within our community in that area, and so a lot of the programs that we bring to this to that center are all about how do we break down stigma around mental health issues, and how do we start to openly have a conversation about, you know, finding resources and you know, improving our situations, because it's a very taboo topic.
Yes, yeah. I wanted to ask, did your mother's career have anything to do with you choosing public health as your major?
No, I don't think that it necessarily impacted my decision to go into public health, but I did get my first job working in a hospital with my mother's help and support. I was interested in like chemistry and medicine from a very young age, say maybe when I was in middle school. I was more interested in medicine. So I wanted to go to pharmacy school. And so that was kind of the narrative that I had for a while, and why I chose biochemistry. But I still plan to go to pharmacy school, but I kind of wanted a broader understanding of health. And I felt like biochemistry was a little bit too limited to give me what I was looking for.
So, other than, you know, your classwork and your work with United Women of East Africa, is there anything else that you participate in? Any other activities or, you know, nonprofit work or internships?
Let's see. Well, I am a part of a student organization on campus called ASA, which is the African Student Association. I am a board member of that organization, and we put together events, and we hold discussions weekly. It's open to all students at UCSD, but we focus more on the, you know, African experience and, you know, what our particular needs are. And we just actually put together this very big event called Celebration of Africa. I don't know if you were there.
I was not there. I do want to join a lot of the different like Black and African and African American related events here on campus. I just haven't like gotten into it yet, and also I like don't know what's happening on campus, but I do want to join in.
Yeah, it was kind of one of the, you know, as a transfer student, it's hard to find your place or find your niche on such a large campus. So joining that organization kind of was really great for me to kind of find people and connect with people that could help me navigate the school a little bit better, because you know, stepping in as a transfer student, you don't really know what's out there, what types of resources the school has for you. And, you know, when you're able to find like a community on campus, you know, through word of mouth, you're able to learn about a lot of things that are going on campus. So that was one of my biggest reasons for joining, and I just really enjoyed being around other Africans as well. So yeah, great.
So I guess before letting you go, I just wanted to talk a little bit about like culture within your family, as well as I guess your experience like here on campus and just, you know, in general with regards to like race as well as gender.
Okay.
So I wanted to ask, what holidays does your family celebrate?
We are Ethiopian Orthodox Christians, and so we observe Christmas and Easter, and we have different holidays to honor different saints. But because we have a different calendar, our Christmas and our Easter doesn't fall on the same days as they do it with most other, like December 25th is not our Christmas. January 7th is actually our Christmas. And Easter is like a week after the Easter that's celebrated here in other parts of the world.
Yeah, your Christmas is actually my birthday. It's funny.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Are there any like special family traditions or customs? You know, has your family created any traditions, you know, mixing together, you know, Ethiopian culture and, you know, experiences here in the United States?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're from my parents or, you know, people that come from other countries and you're raising your kids here in the U.S., you kind of have to compromise, and you know, things that may have not necessarily been a tradition, you know, for them or, you know, from the country that they're from, like for example, like Halloween or Thanksgiving. Those are not things that they celebrated in Ethiopia, but you know, us being here, and it's like you're constantly exposed to it, whether it be just out and about or even at school. I remember elementary, middle school, high school, it's, you know, constant talk of these holidays. And, you know, you just have to, it kind of infiltrates your life and your way of being. And yeah, so we celebrate Thanksgiving. I'm too old to trick or treat now, but my parents, did allow us to go trick or treating. So yeah, we do celebrate. We put up a Christmas tree, we put up lights, we do presents, but on, you know, December 25th. But when we do our own holidays and we do our own Christmas, it's more about getting together with family and having a meal together. It's not really about exchanging gifts. It actually feels like a more of a real holiday, I guess you could say, where you go to church and you pray, and you know, on those days nobody should be hungry. Everybody should have a meal to eat. So it's, you know, a different value system, but we kind of navigate between both cultures.
I completely agree with making sure that no one is hungry. I like the concept of food. And speaking of food, I know that for me personally, I know every Sunday morning, my mom would make eggs and cinnamon rolls for breakfast. So I wanted to ask if your family does something like that, where on a certain day of the week or the month, your family cooks, you know, a certain meal.
No, actually we don't. We are so busy that we don't ever really have a chance to sit down and have a meal together. My parents work all the time, and you know, I'm busy in school, and my brothers are busy with their schools and their extracurriculars, and so it's very rare for us to be able to sit down and have a meal together, which is unfortunate. That's not the way that they grew up. My parents, that's not the way that they grew up. You know, all their meals were together with their family. But here it's so different. We just, you know, when you're hungry, you just go to the fridge and you get yourself a meal. But for different holidays or for different celebrations, we will have a meal together. And there's a lot of Ethiopian food that, you know, my mom prepares for us. You know, there are different breakfast items that we would eat. Yeah. That's kind of the one of the unfortunate things that we, about our interaction, is that we don't really get to sit down and have much time to be a family together.
So would you say that, you know, these holidays, you know, eating together, these are, you know, some of your favorite food related memories, at least?
Yeah. Yeah, I would definitely say so, because there's a lot of food. There's so much food that gets made for these holidays.
Do you have any, like, favorite comfort food?
Yes, so there's something called gumpo, and it's kind of like a porridge. They usually make it, like, for breakfast, or, you know, when someone is sick or when someone just had a baby. It's like one of the best comfort foods.
How about, are there any, you know, songs or images or objects or artifacts that kind of like remind you of your family's origins?
Yes, there's, I listen to Ethiopian music all the time. And we have some instruments at home. My dad knows how to play, but he doesn't really play it very much. Let me see what else. There's a particular sound that always makes me, that I always associate with Ethiopia or, you know, my family's origin. And it's a particular flute. Gosh, I think the name of it is Washint, and it's a very beautiful sounding flute made out of like a wooden, almost like a bamboo, but the way it's played, you know, it can automatically just makes you feel like you're there in Ethiopia.
So are there any like traditions or customs that, you know, you or your family try to preserve? Does your dad, you know, practice with the instruments so that he doesn't forget? Does he, you know, teach anybody how to play the instruments?
Any traditions? I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Are there any traditions that that your family tries to preserve from Ethiopia?
Well, I would say the holidays. My family is very religious, so all of the holidays are, you know, very big for us. Coffee, definitely. Coffee is one of the biggest things in our culture that we preserve, in terms of like, you know, every day, like it's not just like making coffee with a like coffee machine or like a Keurig or anything, but we get like raw coffee beans and we roast them and we grind them ourselves and then we boil them in a special pot, like made out of clay, and you sit down and you have coffee in these small little cups. And it usually takes about, you know, it's like about 2 hours to have this whole process. They call it the coffee, Ethiopian coffee ceremony, or yeah. So that's one of the biggest traditions that I see on a regular basis.
Sounds wonderful, actually. Wow. I would be down for Ethiopian coffee, honest to God. Like, it sounds great. Like, just I don't know, being able to witness something like that would be amazing. But also to taste coffee that, you know, was so meticulously, you know, crafted.
Yeah. Anytime. There I could take you to their Ethiopian restaurants here. They're not too far from the center. Where they can prepare coffee in that way for you. So yeah, definitely you've got to experience it at least once in your life. It's really good, but it's very strong.
Hey, you know, if I told you what I did for my own coffee, you'd probably be alarmed.
What do you do?
Okay, like I'd make cold brew out of espresso. And like really, really this is, you know, it's just like an excess amount of coffee. It's not like actual, you know, quality, not Ethiopian coffee quality, but it, you know, packs a lot of caffeine, which is all I care for really, unless it tastes really good. But yeah, I would make like cold brew out of espresso. So, you know, both cold brew and espresso already have a lot of caffeine in it. And then I would add like instant coffee flakes to it. So it would make it even stronger. So
yeah. What's your major?
Huh? What?
What's your major?
I'm a poli sci major, but oh. my love for extremely strong coffee predates that by a lot.
Okay. Well, maybe you could try some Ethiopian coffee and see if it's strong enough for you.
All right, I'm down. So I guess the last thing I wanted to talk to you about before letting you go is I guess I want to talk to you about like racial and gender experiences and relations. So, you know, you mentioned that at least when you grew up, there were a lot of Ethiopians, you know, there in that area. But, you know, was there any, I guess, how do I explain this? How do you get along with your neighbors? And you know, the neighbors meaning other Ethiopians in Baby Heights, but also like other communities around.
So in terms of just age and gender and those kind of things?
Age, gender, race.
Race. Well, we very much are raised to show respect to our elders. So if they're, you know, even if they're a few years older than you, there's still a level of authority that they have and respect that you have to show them. For example, when you know when someone that's an elder walks in, you know, you should stand on your feet. You should, you know, get up and, you know, greet them. In terms of gender, I would say that, you know, it's kind of we mix a lot. We're not very segregated, but yeah, I don't know how to describe it.
Then I guess I could move on to asking, you know, how does being a, you know, Black African woman affect how people, you know, treat you like here at UCSD or, you know, at Grossmont, or, you know, how we could go back to before you went to college?
Okay. Well, I think my features kind of, people are always trying to figure out what I am or where I'm from because I have a kind of different features, I guess you could say. But I think when I felt it more in high school where, you know, I was taking like AP classes and honors classes, and the high school that I went to, it was predominantly white students that attended. And so I guess I was more conscious of, you know, my ethnicity and my background, like being surrounded by, or just being a minority in general. When I was growing up in a community where everybody was, you know, different, it's not like that, it wasn't that the whole community was Ethiopian, but it was just a large mix of people, you know, like I said, it was Ethiopian, Somali, African Americans, you know, Mexicans. It was just, you're not, I guess, as aware, or it's not as, it doesn't stand out as much as if, as when I was, you know, like maybe the only student of color in these classes. And, you know, the students would even say, you know, because maybe I didn't speak slang, or, you know, they would say that, you know, you speak so white, or, you know, those kind of things. But those are the only things that I kind of recall for the most part.
So only a couple more questions before I'll let you go, because I know you have to get to class soon. So I wanted to ask, so like you mentioned about how there's like that respect for the older generations. Like, have you noticed any, you know, differences in how, I guess, gender is like constructed between, you know, your slash my generation and, you know, older generations? Is there, you know, a more traditional, you know, concept of, you know, what men and women are supposed to do for older generations versus you?
What youth or what younger people are supposed to be doing for,
I say like, you know, what men versus women are supposed to do, I suppose, like gender roles, you know, or do you notice there's a difference in gender roles between, you know, our generation and the older generations?
Okay. These are some great questions. I got to think about it. I think I wouldn't necessarily want to say like my generation in general, because I would say like people that are around my age who are living in Ethiopia are different than the people that are my age that grew up here in the States, and how we operate within the culture. It's very different. I think that my generation that currently lives in Ethiopia, or that have been raised in that culture, you know, where that culture is really ingrained into them, I think it would probably look very similar to how the older generation interacts in terms of gender roles and, you know, other types of characteristics. But here, I think that, you know, with my generation being, you know, you have all these ideas, you know, strong sense of feminism here, and like you have all these, you know, from a young age, you know, through the public schooling system and just in general in media, they instill this whole concept of, you know, a liberty and self-determination and all those things. So it's, I would say that maybe the women living here that grew up here, they would be a little bit more, they would see themselves more as equals when it comes to men and what our roles are in society. But maybe back home, you know, this is just speculation, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I would say that they would fall into more traditional roles of, you know, women as caregivers, you know, housekeepers, and men as, you know, the ones who, you know, do the work, whether it be physical or, you know, kind of being the breadwinner. But, you know, in both situations, education is so highly valued, that it doesn't matter whether you're a male or a female, there's a really strong push for all youth and all you know, my generation in particular to go through school and to, you know, get degrees. So and when it comes to education, I would say that there's very high expectations on both genders to just prevail and to do well, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Finally, I wanted to ask, you know, how do you identify yourself? Do you identify as, you know, Black or African American, you know, person of color, minority?
I identify as Ethiopian American. I don't just see myself as like a minority or I mean, in a practical sense, like you can look around in a room or you can look at the demographics in your neighborhood or your state and you can assess, you know, hey, I am in the minority of, in a minority group of the population, but I identify more so as an Ethiopian American because, you know, I do have a tradition and a heritage that was passed down to me. And, you know, to me, I personally think that being Ethiopian is one thing and being American is another thing. But, you know, being Ethiopian American is a whole different identity of its own. You know, you just kind of have a... you're able to how do I say it? You have so many different perspectives, you know, and for you to kind of get to where you want to be in life, you've got to know how to change your hats or, you know, take certain things from one culture and take some things from the other and kind of use them to your advantage, if that makes sense. You know, when you're doing a census or you're filling out an application, I'm going to be grouped as African American. There's nothing wrong with that at all. It's just that I think calling myself an Ethiopian American fits a little better for me. And it's closer to how I see myself. That's what I think.
So, before we end this, is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, I guess I didn't get a chance to ask you before we began this interview, but what do you hope to gain out of doing these interviews?
I mean, I hope to learn something, you know. I hope to be able to see if I can, you know, connect with someone, if I can relate with someone, 'cause I guess, you know, I kind of have like the occasional identity crisis, you know, because I guess like one, there's so few, you know, Black people on campus, so there are very few people to be able to relate to. But also, you know, I look at myself in the mirror and I'm like, that's not a Black face that I see, you know, when I look at myself. So, you know, I thought maybe I would learn something, you know, learn something new, but also see if I could relate with, you know, relate with people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's my thing.
Okay, and so, I mean, after, is this the first interview that you've conducted?
Yeah, this is the first interview that I've done. This is also like, I mean, I've done interviews before, but never on any topic like this and never to this length.
And so what do you, I mean, in terms of your identity and how you identify as a member of this society, this culture, this American culture, or whatever, however you want to classify it, what new insights do you have from learning about a different culture?
I mean, it's one of those things where it's like you know you say something, but like saying it is completely different from, you know, hearing about it, experiencing yourself. So like, you know, when someone says, you know, we're not so different after all, it's like, well, yeah, of course, you know, duh. But like, it's hard to imagine that kind of concept until you hear from someone, you know, hear them tell you what their life has been like, how, you know, they came to arrive in this location at this time, you know, in the way that they are. So, I think that's part of what I learned. And I think the other thing that I learned is that I think being in that space, being in the South Sudanese center, you know, tutoring kids, you know, if they're there, I guess it, not to say that, you know, that they need me so much as I feel like I need to be there, you know, for myself at least. And that I guess as much as, you know, one's identity should be affirmed, you know, even if I like doubt myself on occasion, and when I say occasion, I mean like a lot, that, you know, it's intrinsic, you know, blackness is intrinsic. So even if I doubt myself, that doesn't change the fact. So I guess I have to remind myself of that.
Yeah, I think one of the things about like being, you know, being a part of the diaspora and, you know, just growing up in a place where maybe your ancestors are not originally from, it kind of puts that doubt in your head. And I think we all deal with that. Like even when you leave, even if you are born abroad and you come to the U.S. or, you know, to another country where it's not necessarily, you know, the life or the culture that you knew or one that you have learned about from your parents, it's very hard to find where you fit into all of that. I definitely can relate as well. It's like, you know, you feel like maybe you're not quite, you know, African enough, or you're not quite American enough. And so you just kind of have to find some sort of middle ground. And then I think, you know, once you start to become comfortable in your own identity and your own self-image, then, you know, those things bother you less over time. But I think it only happens, you know, as you get older.
Yeah. So thank you so much for allowing me to interview you. I know that you know you have to get to the class you're teaching, and yeah. So I hope to be able to talk to you again more about this, more about your own oral history, because I know I have like several questions that I didn't get to ask, but I knew that I had to, you know, get as much as I could before, you know, letting you go. So, sure. I hope you don't mind, me asking if we could, you know, talk again to talk more about, you know, you and your history and, you know, stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah, sure. No problem. I'm on campus a few times in the week, about Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then I'm at the center almost every day, so you can either find me there or find me on campus. But yeah, definitely would like to actually would love to meet you in person. And yeah, maybe we can actually get some Ethiopian coffee too. We can continue this conversation.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm going to stop recording now.